there's shows where I'm like our stage is covered in blood. Does that happen all the time? No, but it's part of what we do.
But we have tarps and real blood.
And we have people that, you know, like conduct that in a very safe and hygienic way.
Today's guests are super cool. It's a couple, Mike Gillespie and Anna Arkaic. They have a company that's called Diatema Arts. Now, essentially, what they are performers, but their performances are very ritualistic. They're grounded in Greek mythology, but they're sort of part of the alternative sort of circus. Imagine fire, imagine sharp things, imagine really beautiful, amazing, creative costumes. We're going to jump right into it with Mike and Anna from Diatema Arts on Caffeinated New Jersey. Hey, what's going on? This is Dave Fletcher, and you're listening to Caffeinated New Jersey. Now, this is a podcast about creativity, where it comes from, what fuels it, and the people out there actually building upon the creative sparks they find daily. Now, every episode, I sit down with artists, musicians, makers, and thinkers from all over New Jersey and sometimes beyond. And we get into real stories, not just what they do, but why they do it. Because somewhere between the ideas, the struggles, and the potential breakthroughs, that's where the spark lives. So whether you're building something of your own or just looking to get inspired, you've come to the right place. So let's get into it. Now, today's episode is a little different in the best way. Diatema of Manitia is a revered ancient Greek priestess and philosopher in Plato's Symposium. Now, she represents a wise, in-between figure, a daimonic, connecting human and divine wisdom. Today, I'm talking with Mike Gillespie and Anna Arkaic, the duo behind Diatema Arts, and what they're creating, not just art. It's layered, it's symbolic, it's fire, and honestly, it kind of lives somewhere between philosophy, storytelling, and visual experience. Their work asks you to slow down, to look a little deeper, and maybe not even try to figure it out right away, but just feel it. So we're going to talk about where this all comes from, how they create together, what Diatema actually means to them, and what it's like building something this intentionally immersive and even a little controversial right here in New Jersey. Mike and Anna, thanks for doing this.
Thank you, Dave.
Thanks.
That was a
So
great introduction. Usually
that's
people
awesome.
have no, I just occurred to me that we've had hours of conversations prior to this podcast. So that's why you're kind of know what we do. It's usually
Yeah.
no clue.
Cool.
Good
Cool. Well,
start.
I think, you know, what I want to do is I kind of want to start before Diatema Arts existed. Like, what were you guys each like creatively as kids?
First.
Me, I was like a wild hot mess as a kid, just like constantly going, moving, restlessness, switching mediums. I was in like every club, doing like all the sports and like in the play, in this and that. So as a kid, I was very like I had like a very restless energy and a constant like it was like a need to just constantly be creating.
To me, she's still a kid.
Yeah. And to me too. Cheers.
Cheers.
We actually have like in our bio, just in case anyone was interested in like the origin, is that, you know, she would put on productions when she was a little girl and used stuffed animals as supporting cast. And then she would like, I could just picture her all frantic, like trying to get everyone to say, come on, that show's happening now. Sit down.
Oh yeah. I would have like little backyard productions and we would learn like choreography. No one would really come. It was
ticket sales were low.
Yeah. Attendance was iffy, but yeah.
I would have went.
Didn't need to produce things, do choreography, do shows, and all of that as well.
Did and Mike, what about your background?
I think I'll fast forward a little bit. I mean, I was still very much a kid, but I think that where I was sort of faced with creativity by necessity was in the realm of restaurants. I threw myself fully into restaurant work, particularly kitchen work. I was enamored with the pace, the struggle, the demented performance principles that are attached to that industry. And, you know, as much as it was really exciting, I kind of found my, for a variety of factors, I just sort of found myself in a loop where, you know, it's long story short, it's not always as glamorous and as interesting as it's portrayed on let's, you know, say these popular television shows or whatever. You know, it can be a real grind and a real beat down. The monotony of it can be a real struggle. And that's one of the things that, you know, we do in our industry right now is the ability to be able to execute very many things consistently over and over and over again. Having the discipline not to deviate, because, you know, when you're in a kitchen, it's like even just putting something down in the wrong spot will throw off your rhythm for the next 15 minutes. You have to be able to execute these movements and be able to work at high volume under high pressure. And that translated immediately into entertainment. I won't bore you with the exact details, but I kind of gave up on the restaurant life and I was doing a lot of odd jobs. And then I met someone who was doing entertainment, but on a very small scale. And this person just needed a lot of help and I was happy to, you know, help. And then years later, I found myself with this being my full-time career. So I, in a sense, hey, I joined the circus and I haven't looked back since. So, does that answer your question?
So
for us, for example, we don't have a choice. We have to be constantly pushing, constantly innovating, constantly creating. Otherwise, it's professional suicide. Now, that's not to say, you know, some of our, I guess, competitors, for lack of a better word, although I think we're in a bracket of our own, you know, have chosen very carved out very little safe spots for themselves. I don't know. They've chosen business names that are very easy to pronounce. They've chosen concepts that are easy to repeat. They've basically mirrored other people's formulas and they work hard. You have to work hard in this industry. There's no way around it. But I mean, I'm just going to go ahead and say that, you know, I think having vision and being able to, I don't really want to reference conquistadors, but you know, we had to burn the ships. I don't condone conquistadors or anything, any of that culture, but you know, we had to burn the ships in order to press forward. And that's like what we do. Like, I see a lot of posts right now. It's very trendy for like performers to be like, can you only imagine what my real people at my real job would think about this? And then they show like a scene of them performing. And I'm like, wow, like, you know, that's our real job. Like, we don't have the other thing that you are keeping, you know, separate. But yeah, creativity is an essential part. Without it, we're either growing or we're dying. That's the way I see it.
Right. So going back to when you were either in, you know, in school or a little bit later on, I mean, were you was part of your creative journey being attracted to the theater?
I was one of the original basement boys. I mean, like D&D was huge. I mean, we would get off of school on Friday and we would play Dungeons and Dragons in my friend's basement or my basement, whoever, and we would play till Sunday night until we were being like yanked back into reality. I mean, that was one of the things. I'm glad you brought that up because, you know, working in kitchens, I mean, I had great, you know, the camaraderie and, you know, you like the partnerships and the adventures, it's all very real, but you know, I wasn't able to connect with people. I mean, I was still reading voraciously. Like I would, you know, and there was no one to really talk about fantasy literature with. There was no one to talk about romantic poetry or cinema. You know, everyone was sort of wrapped in a very small world that involved, you know, things, substances and food. Let's just say that. And, you know, I was always longing to do the type of work that would allow for me to tap into just, I mean, having read, you know, at this, I would say thousands of fantasy literature and science fiction books, like, yeah, I mean, was it entertaining? Sure. But that lives in me and it comes out in our work too. I'm sure we'll talk more about the creative process. I'm not just saying that I'm like regurgitating other people's work, but I mean, that all of that needed a home. And, you know, my years of playing fantasy, you know, fantasy role playing definitely shaped the way we structure our shows, the narrative, the story first, then the acts, then the performance. That all is very important to it.
Anna, did you participate in theater as well when you were younger in yeah. high school? Or yeah,
I mean, and, I started. Oh, sorry. What were you?
No, go ahead.
I started on stage when I was 7. Was like my first like show, and then that was like my streamline into like productions. Like I did the school plays, I did community theater, I studied theater, I went to a theater high school, I studied drama. It was only performing arts. We had two majors, drama or dance, and I was a drama major, so I did that for 4 years. And then when I went to college, I was taking music and theater classes. I was in all the plays in college. Like musical theater and drama theater are probably my most training I have. That's all throughout my life. I have a lot of training. I had different coaches and schools and all that, blah, blah, blah. But definitely theater is a very strong, that was like my foundation for everything.
Mm-hmm. Did either of you, you know, at some point, you know, in your younger lives, Mike, you were talking about D&D, you're seeing these sort of fantastical creatures, you know, as part of those worlds. Were you somebody that you'd say cosplayed? Did you kind of create, you know, did you create costumes? Did you find yourself that immersed in the environments, or was it just, you know, some folks getting together in a basement and playing D&D?
More of the latter. I mean, we had some fun, like little cloaks and things. I mean, we played with it, but not to the extent that we see now. I mean, cosplay culture is tremendous. I mean, the amount of work that these people put into these looks, it's incredible. I just wish that they would get paid more for their work, but I mean, not everything needs to be for free and for fun. And at the same time, not everything has to have a price tag, but you know, these costumes are beautiful. Now I do. Now we have headpieces. Now we do things. I mean, we're not very great at sewing, so we get help with that. But I mean, I could show you. I mean, we have books of papers and notes and all drawings and diagrams, all kinds of things that we're working on. I mean, there's all types of props and installations, things that need to be fabricated that just live on paper right now. And they're fleshed out, they're thought out, but they just have to be made. Mm-hmm. We're always building. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But not back then, not so much. It was just, you know, guys getting together in Metallica t-shirts and D&D.
Were there any art teachers or anyone who was kind of a mentor when it came to, you know, creativity? You know, in other words, you know, Anna, if you were, you know, doing the theater stuff, did you find that there was someone who was in, you know, the stage building side of things that kind of, in addition to you on the performer side, you were like, wow, that's really cool what they're doing. I want to learn how to do that stuff.
Yeah, I was honestly, I have to say, growing up, I had a lot of great mentors and people who definitely like believed in me and gave me a lot of opportunity. Even on the performance side, you know, just like I had a lot of support in people who wanted to see me thrive in the arts, which was, you know, really helpful. But I would say I started getting more into like the production and leadership side. There was a theater camp that I went to for many years as a kid. And then once I was old enough, I started teaching there in the summers as well. and I would do a lot of directing. I would run, I learned how to run the soundboard. I learned, you know, I did a lot of like choreography, things like that. So, and helping with music, helping like with a lot of different sides and being able to almost be alongside the director. So I had a teacher and she was literally like my music teacher since I was 5 years old. So, and her name is Mrs. Green, and she was just, she was from London. She had a lovely English accent, and she was just like a lovely woman. Like she just loved kids. She loved her job. And yeah, so I had a job there and she was the main director, but she did a lot to make sure that that play, that those kids put on a play at the end of every summer. Mm-hmm. And I learned a lot, you know, I learned a lot about just like the basic side of, you know, production. And, you know, I would even do their makeup sometimes. Like I would have like a lot of different little roles that I could kind of play with, which was cool.
And Mike, you grew up in New York, right? In Long Island?
Yeah.
Is that where you were born?
Yeah.
Okay. Whereabouts in Long Island?
Huntington, Suffolk County.
Huntington. Okay. Yeah. Now, was there any element of theater or visual arts, you know, there that kind of led you in this direction that you guys have gone right now, or did that come much later after, you know, after that?
I would have to say much later. I don't know if it was the arrogance of youth. I wasn't really interested.
Did you get into trouble a lot?
I did.
Yeah?
Yeah, I did.
Surprise, surprise.
But I didn't really listen to people. I never had teachers that kind of inspired me. I had an art teacher once that was like kind of cute, and I know she liked some good music or whatever. But like, other than that, you know, I didn't really pay attention to school. I mean, when I went into restaurants, I was very inspired by a few chefs who took me under their wing, and they saw potential in me, and they were very hard on me. It was a different time, you know, can't really kind of get away. The culture has changed, let's put it that way. But sure. I love them for it. And they imparted a work ethic into me. I mean, it's almost like I'm still scared about like stopping. Like I'm afraid that like I'm going to get yelled at if I'm not like constantly moving, kind of a thing. And it was a toxic culture though. You know, like if you didn't, like, God, I mean, like we have a lot of people on our cast and people are very reliable and responsible. Every once in a while, we'll try to take on someone new and they just kind of like don't understand that like being on time is important. And it's just like, God, if I was late, I mean, you would get tortured all day long. Like, you know, like you would be made fun of all day long. Like if you were late to your job, like if you were late while your team was there working and you were late, I mean, you're eating alone. No one's talking to you, like that kind of a thing. But, I mean, it took some things to happen in my life. I mean, you know, like getting sober and having, you know, some philosophical and spiritual awakenings really opened up my eyes. I can see that in youth, I had tunnel vision. So for her, you know, having a teacher that just like, that's a really heartwarming. It wouldn't have been my experience at the time. Now I continuously find myself intrigued by, baffled by, inspired by all types of people, dudes I train with at jiu-jitsu, random people I run into at the deli, all kinds of people have the potential to evoke that in me now, because I have a more expansive view than I did in my youth.
So you're in Huntington, you're beginning to kind of, as you're getting a little older, you're working in restaurants in the city. So are you still living in Huntington, or have you moved to the city at that point, or moved closer?
No, I was commuting. It was hard.
Okay. Okay. And Anna, you grew up in South Jersey, right?
No, I grew up. No,
yeah, she did.
I'm a Taylor Ham girl. I grew up kind of near Elizabeth in Roselle Park.
Okay.
It's a small 1 square mile town. Yeah, but still close enough to the city, so I'd go into
a lot. Interestingly enough, a small town, but it's, you know, I don't want to get too much into what's happening to theater and arts programs, but you had a good enough arts and theater program in a very small area that it kind of helped lead you in the direction that you've gone in now. You mentioned you had the mentors, including the music teacher. As you're getting a little bit older, because I'm trying to figure out how you guys met. I know your background a little bit, you've done a lot of music. You've become a songwriter. Performer, getting into the coffee kind of world or cafe sort of world, because you've worked in restaurants and as well, and doing coffee and stuff like that. So Mike's out in New York, and you're in Jersey. How do you guys come together? Like, where do you meet?
We met on an unremarkable gig.
Yeah.
I remember she came in and she went, "Hi, friends." Like she always does, whenever she goes into a green room, that's what the first thing she does with her. And we were just chit-chatting. It was like a kid's entertainment. This was a while
ago. Face painting.
Yeah, it's like beginning, end of 2017 or beginning. And yeah, something like that. It was a while ago. And
so we're working for different companies?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. And maybe we can talk a little bit about, So entertainment companies, you're doing this kind of as a side gig, Mike, because you're still working in restaurants at that point as well?
Good question. I think I had no, I got lured back in for a spell.
Okay.
A friend of mine opened up a restaurant and I got the dreaded text, "Hey, come help for a little bit," and then a little bit like turned into a lot, and I had to put the kibosh on that. But I was doing full force. It's definitely doing full force entertaining at the time. Yeah. I had my own fully developed company. I was in it to win it at that point.
Yeah. You had your own company at that point, but we were working for someone else.
A friend of ours who lives in Florida now.
But he had his own company, and me, I was just freelancing, doing a lot of different things. So
she was enjoying. Yeah. She was always busy. We started talking, and then I would hire her for events, and then it was always like we kind of struck up a friendship early on, and then it was always like Russian roulette. Like I would call, "Oh, I have this event, like Anna, are you available?" And I was like, wait for the text message. I would see that she's like writing back, and it would be like yes or no, like yes, what are the details? Like so, you were busy. You were always doing stuff.
Did you guys both, when you first sort of understood that you were going to build something together, did you immediately see like a shared vision? Like it was like, pow, okay, we are destined to work together. We have this shared vision through conversations we've had and through, our backgrounds and our collective interests. Or did that sort of build over time?
It was nothing, and then it was something. Yeah. Once it was something, it was undeniable. So
how did it become something?
Those conversations about building something together,
and
those long talks.
I would say the something is pretty like on the nose. That something was in Celtic in mythology, and there's a word. It's called Awen, and that's like inspiration, divine breath. And for us, like that concept was something that we were toying with and building, you know, whether it was like going to be a production or a show, like we were just kind of like milling around this story, these ideas based around this concept of just this breath of inspiration.
Incidentally, the symbol for Awen is three eyes, and they're sort of angled in.
Looks like an A.
And I don't think Diatima. That's another thing with the pronunciation. Like the Greek might pronounce it slightly different. I'm sure the ancient Greeks would have something to say about the way we're treating the name. I don't think she would mind. We put three eyes in the middle of her name instead of one to symbolize Awen, which is the foundation, the Celtic inspiration as the foundation of our creative enterprise. And also that's representative of, you know, you spoke beautifully about in between three eyes, right? So not this, not that, something else. And also triple goddess mythology, particularly the Morrigan from Celtic mythology. She has different aspects, and you can call it like the fates or the mother, the maiden, and the crone, or the idea of this middle thing as being a very distinct possibility as well.
Pushing past the idea of duality, you know, kind of giving, making room, making space for that up, that third. I feel like we're in a very, like, there's a lot of duality right now, like this side and that side in the world, you know? So just giving space for that, that third, that in between to live, give that breath, you know?
But you need, the thing is too, like, you know, you always speak beautifully about like Elizabeth Gilbert, and there's other people who have written extensively about creativity as a current. Something that you tap into, something that happens to you. Like I won't say who it is, but a fantasy author that I have adored for years, you know, like he's famous for saying like, it's like writing's not that hard. You just think up a bunch of stuff and then write it down. And I'm like, oh, that's just like not right. That's just not true. You know, we become this conduit for the inspiration. And if the structure isn't there, the idea goes, ooh, this isn't a good place to materialize. I'm going to go somewhere else. And so the structure can be dualistic in that there are many times where we're like, that does not look good. This looks good instead.
Yeah.
That's as simple as we're going to make it. Like, and that's a distinct and very real outcome in a lot of our scenarios, the ability to make distinctions. But, you know, at the end of the day, you know, we are exploring that middle territory as an ethos, as the thing that grounds us. And we're kind of honoring the tradition of an evolving form, which is not inherently set. It's static. It's not static. It's in motion.
So you're creating with intention, kind of, you know, it says that on your website, in your story, by creating with intention, how does that, like, what does that look like when you guys are sitting down to create a show or an event?
It can look a lot of different ways. I think that first and foremost, we're sort of tapped into the idea that we're not, you know, creating things. We are, but at the same time, we're allowing things to happen. We're choosing, we're letting curiosity do the work. We're allowing there a friction to occur. And, you know, whether it's love or whether it's art, you know, we're looking for that tension that the friction brings on. And that's what allows us to create. I mean, there are times where we have to just dress a stilt walker, and that stilt walker has to look good, and they have to be able to walk on stilts, and they have to wear a certain color, and they have to perform for a certain time. Does that require us to like get our creative juices flowing? You know, do we have to have a storyboard and really get into it? No, but we've done all that before, so we're able to do that. A lot of times we have to check a box, and that's okay because that's what we do professionally. There's a lot that goes on to doing what we do.
It could go either way. Sometimes it's easy as a client, you know, wants us to do a show somewhere and they want it to have a certain feel. So we're like, okay, cool. And then we kind of, we'll just like mill over a bunch of different like titles of the show. And then for me, like one of my main things I like to do is I like to dive into the music. So I'll make like playlists based on certain artists that match certain concepts for shows. So I'll go through and I'll create playlists and be like, I think it should sound like this, 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 and this. And being able to kind of build a feel, like for me, a lot of like even my own acts and what I create as a part of the shows we do start with the music. How does it sound? Because, you know, how does it sound is how does it make you feel, you know, for a lot of people. A lot of people are able to connect immediately to sound, me being one of them. And, you know, of course, visual as well, you know, being able to create mood boards, you know, storyboarding.
That's another thing, too. Let's see. I don't want to kind of go into a critical, like, I don't want to be overly critical of anyone or their methodology. I mean, I use social media because I have to. I don't think that it's very good for me as a creative. I don't, when we create a mood board, it's not necessarily like, let's go find a bunch of pictures of what other people are doing. You know, our mood boards tend to be a little esoteric, and we're hoping that people can view it as such. And listen, there are performers that, like, you just say, like, hey, I want it to be this, I want it to be that, and blah, blah, blah. And they're like, yeah. Like, and then there are performers that are like, you need to tell me where to stand and for how long. Like, mm-hmm. do these shoes make sense? Like, please tell me. Like, I don't know if they do or not. Like, so there's all different types of people. Luckily, like, we have a really good core crew that they're professional entertainers. They're artists. They have an artist mentality. They're very tapped into everything that we're saying. And when you work with someone, you know, just like at the cafe, I mean, there's people that you don't have to talk. You can just work and you can just let things happen. And, you know, sometimes, you know, someone has it's like almost like with editing, right? You have to kind of get rid of things that don't work, even though you love them. I hate to be the one to say an act doesn't work. You know, someone worked on something so beautifully and it looks so good, but, you know, it's just not right for that show.
Yeah.
Or just, you know, a costume. You know, luckily we have a good, like, there can be like a little bit of tension, but, like, you know, we could say to each other, that doesn't work. Like, we need to get rid of that costume. Like, and we get rid of it and we go back to the drawing board, or we do something, we pivot, you know.
There's a lot of emotion sometimes attached to it, because it can be a very emotional process, especially when we're building more on the passion side as opposed to just the business side.
Yeah.
So, being able to let go too is as important as being able to receive, you know. Receiving and also being able to let go and be like, this is just not gonna work for this, and I worked so hard on it, but it just has to
go. These archetypes, know? These things that we're using, right? And I mean that in the most respectful sense, right? Like, I'm not using figures from mythology. I'm being used by them in a very distinct way, but they're not these ideas and these concepts, these things that we play around with. I don't want to say play around, but these things that we utilize every single day are not precious and detached. We have to get our hands on them and we have to see what works. They have to be used. It, you know, a famous chef, Marco Pierre White, sort of a contentious figure in cooking. He was like our hero. I'm a little older than some of the, you know, but like, he said, no fingers, no food. You get your hands in there, you get dirty, you mess with it, you see what works. And luckily, we both work really hard. We work with people that are incredibly talented and very, but they have a different, you know, maybe their position is very detached and they need to, like, take some time with something. We're so busy that we've kind of, like, the way our creativity works, you know, that, again, that creativity by necessity, we have sort of a different pace. Like, we have to make things work. So the space makes requirements. The space asks us for things. The client asks us for things. The day in which we do things asks us for things. The season, the town, whatever town it is, like, whatever it is, there's all these things sort of chiming in and trying to get us to produce something for all of them. And that allows us to think outside of the box. I would love to. So, like, whether it's face painting or whether it's cooking food, you know, like, yeah, you can go ahead and make an entirely new menu every single day based on what's available at the farmer's market. That sounds wonderful. It's not really, really realistic for a lot of folks. They have to find things that work. They have to find things that can make profit, that people enjoy, and they have to be able to do it day after day after day after day very quickly and efficiently. And that's one of the things that, you know, we've sort of cultivated in our experience, our professional experience, is a sense of urgency. We work very quickly. We don't sit on it. You know, like, we're thinking about shows in October right now, and you might say, like, well, that's plenty of time. It's actually not. It's not. We're already we're already behind the eight ball on some of this stuff in October. We should have been there are certain projects we should have started in January. We're starting just right now. And that's okay. I like the pressure. Anna likes the pressure. You know, it can be difficult, but we wouldn't have it any other way. Right. I guess
you're sort of at the mercy of clients a lot of times. And I understand that. I mean, as a graphic designer, I felt that as well. In fact, you know, I tended to believe that artists were not graphic designers. I felt that graphic designers, as a graphic designer, your job is to solve a problem and use your skill set to solve that problem, but not put yourself into it, put the client into it. So there's that side of the business that you're in. Is there an aesthetic that Diatima, you know, projects? And if there isn't, is there a direction that in a perfect world that everything you do would have a particular aesthetic that is part of you? Because I feel like in a lot of ways, the work that I've seen and the stuff that I've seen online when you've shown me photos and stuff, there's a particular aesthetic I feel, but I also know on the other side, you know, there's going to be a kid's party that is part of the business aspect of it. But the aesthetic of the two of you, what would you describe that as?
We have a very distinct aesthetic where we have a very liminal, ritualistic, myth-driven aesthetic.
Dark.
Avant-garde, dark, challenging material.
It is dark, yeah.
Challenging material. I mean, we can't post all of the stuff that we do because it's not friendly for Instagram. We work with beautiful people. Male-presenting, female-presenting, non-binary. We work with beautiful people, all different types of beautiful people. And whether they're fully clothed or whether they're naked or whatever it is, you know, in Plato's Symposium, when we meet Diatima, you know, she articulates theories of eros and she always talks about how love starts with physical. We admire beauty. We love our physical body. We do not want our physical body to be harmed. We want it to be healthy. We want to feel good sensations. And then that leads way to an intellectual beauty that we get to share with others, and we immerse ourselves in subjects that we music and things that we enjoy, and we become creative and we become artists. And then all of that is just a pathway to divine love. And that's really where you want to be. And no matter what people believe, you know, whether it's the god of science or some other goddess or something like that, you know, we're sort of dabbling in that realm, you know, and we're happy to be there. So it starts with beauty. And I think that our work is beautiful. Like, I watch videos of what we do, and it impresses me so much that we, you know, and I'm not like sitting there like, we built this thing, like, no, we our friends are the most creative people I know. Like, we've brought all kinds of people down to the shop, mm-hmm. and I'm constantly impressed by and inspired by the people. Anna is my muse. Like, I used to joke before we were a couple. I used to say I would always talk, like, I would refer to her as my muse all the time. People probably like, what's going on there? But you know, you need that. I know I need that. Like, it's important.
Thanks.
Well, okay.
And cut. No, that's great. And a lot of creative people don't necessarily have that advantage to not only, you know, work together, but to love one another while they're working together. A lot of times, you know, going down the road in those sort of relationships, there's some sort of creative impasse that you reach that drives the two apart. How do you deal with it when, you know, you're working on a piece, you know, for a show, and you don't see eye to eye?
That's a great question. It happens all the time. I guess it happens so much that we don't really, it's push and pull. Like, I mean, I know that I need, like, here's the thing. Like, when I, like we talked, when we were talking before about youth and you were like, hey, were there teachers? Like there's nothing my teachers could have said that would have resonated with me. It wouldn't have stuck. Like, I was too immersed in my own world. And then when you get sort of, let's just say, attached to substances, you know, the selfishness goes off the charts. And so when I got sober, it taught me how to be teachable, you know, and I had to have, you know, as a grown man, I had to have another sober grown man tell me, you know nothing about living, you know nothing about staying sober. You are a child, and all you need to do right now is listen and show up. You have nothing valuable to say. And I was like, wow, like, okay, I guess I could try that on for size, you know. I know that there are times where I'm completely off the mark, like where I think something needs to be a certain way, and I might even be adamant about it. Like I can be very persuasive. I can be very like, you know, and then Anna's, you know, luckily she's way more patient than I am. She'll just kind of let me roll with it. And then she'll just jump in sometimes at the right moment, sometimes at the, you know, whatever it is. And then we have a discussion and then I realize I'm wrong and we change direction. Right. I mean, is that fair?
If all goes well, yes. Sometimes it's intense. Like, you know, I'm not going to sugarcoat it. Mm. Like that's part of it.
Yeah.
All of this is intense. Like all of our work is intense. Our aesthetic, like, our concepts, the creative process, the amount of hours that it takes to do things, and, you know, driving all over. It's intense. So it's going to get intense. It does get intense at times. It's just being able to move through the intensity, which is basically like a lot of the basis for our concept of what we do.
We get
like
it out
sideshow.
Fast,
yeah,
right?
We'll
do like the silent treatment for like a little bit or whatever, or we'll like, we'll take off, we share our locations so we don't have to like ask you, you know, we'll like remove our locations or whatever, and like, you know, just kind of like go off it, which is like healthy and fine, but we get things out really fast and then we get over it and we get back to work. So in a lot of ways, you know, our work is a blessing. I don't want to say it's all like, I think we've both agreed that if our work disappeared, we would still be a couple. But it's both challenging and it's also a tremendous blessing to be able to work with your partner all the time and work on beautiful things. Before we were together, when we were just business partners, I was living in New York and I was literally like, I'd be like, because we would have a meeting every day and I'd be like, okay, we have to like write emails. I'm like, I should probably come out and we should have lunch to write this email. Like, I was like always trying to find excuses for us to meet up and get together. And we were going to shows all together all the time. We were doing a lot of stuff. But now we get to be together as much as we want. And if we need space, we get to do that too, you know, which is nice.
Couple of final questions as we kind of wrap this up. From each one of you, I'd like to know kind of when you're putting together a show for someone, what is your go-to for initial sort of sparks of inspiration?
Want me to go? I know mine.
Oh, yeah, I know mine too.
Go, you go.
For me, yeah, like I said before, for inspiration, I like to know how something's going to sound. So music is kind of my first go-to.
Specific musicians?
Yeah. So, you know, for example, like the After Circus has more... in terms of like specific, it has more of like an industrial.
The After Circus being one of our productions.
Yes, that's one of our productions.
In New Orleans.
Which is like kind of this like apocalyptic circus feel, dark, edgy, but high energy. I tend to pull a lot of like industrial, dark wave. You know, Chelsea Wolf being one of the, you know, one of the artists, you know, Nine Inch Nails, like things of that nature, more industrial, more like, you know, vibey in that way. And then in terms of like, you know, some of our other shows, for example, like Fair Shadows, that's more witchy. It's more like magical, more ritualistic. We might pull from more like, you know, Heilung, like more like Viking-y, like tribal, you know, more in that realm. Or just, I pull a lot of like female vocal because we're a very like feminine forward brand, and feminine in the sense of the energy, not necessarily like being a woman, you know, but having the feminine energy, you know, so we dabble in that a lot. So, yeah, so a lot of like
jazz is also kind of important. Metal, all kinds. We listen to all kinds of stuff.
We just did a industrial festival this past weekend. It was in Parsippany called Dark Force, and I was talking with the organizer, and he was like, "Yeah, you guys always use good music," and he, you know, rattled off a few of the musicians that, you know, he's heard us play. And I'm like, okay, great. Because those were like deliberate choices that I made, you know, to make those connections.
Also
to reach
mention
certain
that
people.
Anna's an incredible musician. You know that. I mean, not just from open mic, but I mean, she helps edit these beautiful pieces. And we're working on stuff, too, that's original for specifically for Diatema, dark acoustic and some electronic stuff. We're kind of behind schedule on that. We should have had it ready already for this season, but maybe next year or maybe by the end of this year or whatever. But there's stuff happening.
Yeah, I like to edit, like, I'll put, you know, even like spoken word over tracks and edit certain things together, certain sounds, certain soundscaping, being able to call in, pulling from a lot of different artists, even like laying down some basic layers of production. Very important. Especially like if you have an act, it's not always just going to be like one song. Like there's a story, it's got an arc. So sometimes it has three or four different songs, and being able to pull and make it a one cohesive thing is its own. But something I've always been in love with, you know, building a production.
Mike?
Yeah, I mean, applied mythology. That's really how I live my life. I try to approach our work as a who, not as an it. And in terms of like inspiration, you know, I'm always drawn to Bergman, the Swedish director. I love the landscapes. I love David Lynch. I love the silence and the stillness and the bleak quality that are imparted. I love the dream logic over Western math logic and rational logic. I love the idea of beauty and unease existing together. What music or just
no,
I mean
sin, yeah, your first source of inspiration, so more visual.
Yeah, when you're putting together a show,
I'll throw on an Ingmar Bergman film. Like I'll throw on like Seventh Seal or like Persona or something like that. I'll put on music. You know, I'm always reading fiction, but you know, these stories that these mythology, like, I mean, any archetype, you know, like the idea of like the trickster, the shadow, the oracle, like the monster, anything that's like sort of monstrous and challenging. You know, I love that. You know, David Lynch, obvious. I think I mentioned that already, right? Mm-hmm. You know,
I like David Lynch because from a musical aspect too, David Lynch pulling music too is like such a big influence for us. I've pulled a lot from David Lynch.
Plus, there's the one of the things that like with our productions too is like so like visual minimalism to sort of evoke a feeling and to kind of create a sense of yearning. I used to just think like especially with our fire shows, like we need to have constant fire. We need to have big like, and people love that. I mean, don't get me wrong. It's almost like it will entertain you if that's what you want. Like you're going to be entertained, but like. We're looking to do a little better than that. Mm-hmm. So we want to evoke feelings, and that involves pacing, and it involves atmosphere and tone, and a lot of times silence is a part of that. Yeah. Like I love looking out into the audience and seeing people like kind of like, did they stop? Or they, and they're like looking at each other and then it starts again. You know, I love seeing that. I love like the sound design as a psychological space. And then, well, I don't want to talk about Plato. I mean, but like there's the whole idea too of, you know, our objective is not to like, we created something and I hope you like it. It's like, we all know this already. If you want to go by Plato's epistemology, this is all stuff that we're collectively remembering together. And if we tap into something like you've already been there because, you know, you want to call it a soul, you want to call it whatever it is, you were in eternity with this idea or this concept already. And we're just presenting it for you so that you, whatever you want to call it, goes, ah, I know what that is. I was there once before. And that's, you know, Plato wrote the symposium where we meet Diatema. There's a lot of challenges with Plato. I don't really want to get into it, whatever. But the idea of his epistemology, I think, is really beautiful. That this is all recollection. This is all remembering. This is all, you know, yeah. It's an evolving form. There's a tradition, and we're just trying to put our own creative spin on it. But at the end of the day, we're receiving, and happy to be doing that.
Storytellers, but storytellers in a very primal kind of sense.
Mm-hmm. Fire is so inherently like tribal and dangerous, and it, like, you want to just talk about like the Freudian, the id, right? Like, what does the id want? To like burn shit to the ground. And we see fire and it's dangerous, but there has to be structure. It has to be controlled. Mm-hmm. Otherwise there's no art. If we hurt ourselves, there's no art. If we hurt other people, that's not art. I mean, maybe it could be. I would have to examine. Someone would have to really have a good argument for that. I don't think so. There needs to be safety, you know, and just being able to do all this. Like, if we can just get the safety down, right? Like, then we can get really wild with
it. And above all else, respect. Yeah. Like, you have to respect the fire. And it's like, some of us will say that we're asking for permission. So you ask the fire for permission to work with it, you know, because we get a little arrogant sometimes, and we're like, well, I've been doing this for over a decade, and it's like, it doesn't matter.
And then you burn your hand really yeah. bad, and you go, oh, I remember. I mean, I have.
But yeah, so, and that's the thing too. It's being able to keep the ego in check as well, and respect that fire is dangerous. Fire demands respect, and that, you know, we're artists and we're creating, but you still have to ask permission. And that's the intention behind it too, is asking permission for you to be able to work with the fire. You know, you're working with fire.
And which is the same thing.
Thing.
Permission, you know? From the people that do it with us too. It's not just a top down, like, here's money, do cool shit. You know, we're asking artists to participate, you know, whether it's their likeness, whether it's their vision. I mean, we're always very respectful. I mean, at the end of the day, like, I'm the one who spends a lot of money to keep this thing going. So I have a right to make certain requests of people, but I never want to stifle that. Like, I never want people to feel like they can't be themselves. We deliberately select people that are doing incredible work. And I love being in a position of, like, if I can trust someone, like, we have some people where I know that they know how to keep themselves safe, how to keep other people safe. They know how to respect our clients and our contracts, because, you know, get all that out of the way, get the business stuff out of the way, because this is very much a business. We can't, you know, this is not a collective or a community. Those things are great, but there's a lot of exploitation that happens with community. A lot of people doing free stuff. A lot of people being forced to do low-paying stuff for the sense of a you know, big whatever it is. This is a business, and we're very good at it. But if we can get all that out of the way and sort of not see it as an icky part of what we do, you know, because money is not evil. It's a tool, mm-hmm. and there's an energy to it. It's an energy exchange. So if we can get paid and we can make sure that people respect the contract, then there's really like a great place for art to happen.
How important is the edge? And you know what I mean by the edge, you know, of how far you will go. How close to it are you willing to get in a performance? And I don't think the answer is just as close with it still being safe in order to satisfy your creative, your creative vision.
It depends on the room, honestly, really what may be edgy to, you know, somebody who lives in Cedar Grove is not going to be the same amount of edgy as to somebody who's an artist in Brooklyn. Because there's just like...
Fair enough.
There's crazy things happening at venues like The Box or House of Yes or some of the other, you know, late night nightclub type venues that are pushing way past.
And that's one
limits.
Of the things we said is that we don't want to try to be like the... Like, because some of it, it's just like... We get the sense now that it's a lot of people just trying to see who could be the craziest artist in New York City.
Yeah.
And which is cool. Like, have at it. Like... But it's a little distasteful to us. We're not trying to top anyone. We're not trying to just do, like, perform gratuitous, you know, like, sensory overload for people.
It depends on the room.
I mean, edgy can mean a lot of things. I mean, we have there's shows where I'm like, our stage is covered in blood. Does that happen all the time? No, but it's part of what we do.
But we have tarps.
Yeah.
I mean, fake and real blood.
And we have people that, you know, like, conduct that in a very safe and hygienic way. I mean, there could be spiritual edginess. You know, people are always intrigued and horrified by the idea of, like, the devil or whatever. I mean, we've performed shows for, like, all kinds of religious and anti-religious organizations, we'll put it that way. I guess edginess could be, like, the amount of clothing someone wears. I mean, like,
it really, really depends, because it's all about...
We're not looking to upset people.
Well, I mean, we had somebody...
But we want to challenge people.
Who though. Pretended to eat a baby on stage, and we had a couple walk out and say the baby was too much. And listen, it's not a real baby. Like, it's a fake baby, and it was a witch act, you know? Do I think that's, like... the edge? No. But for that person, it was.
That was their threshold.
That was their threshold.
And we have to respect that. Like, I wasn't trying to upset them. You know, who knows what could have happened or, you know, is happening in their personal life that would, you know, make them leave like that. I mean, I'm not going to sit here and make a list of all the very interesting and bizarre things that we do. I could, but you understand. We're mm-hmm. always trying to find that place. And ultimately, when you say the edge is, you know, what's the extent that you're willing to go? We're not looking to do a disservice to our clients, you know, because this is a business. We're you know, and this comes back to restaurants, right? Like, you want to talk about, like, so let's just say everyone we work with is a chef, right? And that's great. Like, chefs, people always have like a fetish for chefs. It's like, okay, cool. Like the guy that makes the food is great. I was that guy. But there's so much that needs to happen in order for that chef to make a plate of food. Mm-hmm. You know, there's light bulbs, there's floors, there's permits, there's all kinds of expenses. There's all kinds of, like, there's architects, there's designers. I mean, there's all these kinds of things. And if the chef stays and maybe he's given a percentage of the restaurant, cool. Like, maybe another chef comes. Maybe the chef becomes an owner. I don't know. We have to respect the client. We have to respect the people that are coming to see us. Now, we do our best. We give a disclaimer that there might be, like, shocking content, this and that. But I just think it's really distasteful when people are just, like, trying to top each other and just, like, because anyone could just do, like, crazy stuff. I mean, like, yeah. Think about it. Just let that id go a little bit. I mean, gosh, I mean, horror movies, right? Like, I mean, I love horror movies, but some of them are just...
Yeah.
It's not even interesting.
It's deliberate.
Anymore. It's just, you know, we don't want to be that way. People are always like, I mean, we're really popular during Halloween because of the darker nature of our aesthetic. And we always get asked by, like, haunt attractions, and they never have enough money and whatever. But we're really busy during Halloween. But, like, we're not just, like, trying to be horrific all the time. Like, there's all different types of... There's all historical periods and historical figures,
but
and
we're always
that we're interested in and inspired by.
Yeah, and we're always aware of the acts. Like, the acts aren't just like we're always handpicking and very deliberate on in terms of what acts that we want in specific shows in front of specific audiences. Because sometimes we're in a more of a nightlife setting where we can get really weird and bizarre and all. And sometimes we are performing dark material, but there's kids there. So it's like, the edge is like, we cannot be stripping, we can't be doing certain things because there are children present, and we don't want to, we're still going to stay true to our brand, we're going to introduce some dark esoteric concepts, but we're not trying to create controversy in that way. You know, so
right.
So we are able to walk between many different worlds, and we're very deliberate on the acts that we allow in front of certain audiences.
There's almost never, I mean, like, there's not, that's not for Diatima, we don't usually, there's usually not children.
I mean, Lunar Fair.
But no, what I'm trying to say is, like, there are certain big oddities markets where people just bring their kids. And even if it's a late show, you know, So we just know not to go past a certain point.
It's but, deliberate.
Yeah. We're never in danger in that area.
Usually for like a lot, you know, some of the night markets that we do, some of the conventions, like there are all ages present. So we are just, we're very deliberate on, you know, what we allow to happen because of that.
But the edge is always evolving, right? You know, there's a tension and a release to any figure ground structure. There's always, so the edge might change.
It does. Of course it has to.
Depending on a variety of factors. The edge might be different in New Orleans than this year.
It is.
Yeah. It is.
Does the edge ever change during the performance?
Yes.
Do you?
It has. How
do you adjust? I mean, because you have a, presumably it's not just you two, there's a team that's out there. How do you plan for, or not plan for adjustments, you know, in the show, when that changes a lot, you know, while it's going on?
Well, we're not like detached, you know, talent buyers. The people that we work with are our friends, and you know, just like someone we worked with last weekend, like they did an act that I've seen like 30 times, and I still love seeing it. It's great.
What was it?
What's that?
What was the act?
She uses a grinder plate and she shoots sparks off of her body, and they do all kinds of cool stuff.
But the point is she has sparkler boobs.
Yeah. So like, are they just going to like pull out a chainsaw and like cut off one of their limbs one day? No, they're not. They're not, like, we know that they're not going to do that. The edge, if we weren't directly involved in what happens on our stages, yeah, we would be surprised to see that the edge has shifted. Now, you can't control everything. We try to, and that's okay. You know, chefs control things. You know, we do our best to control as much as possible while letting people do, you know, what they do. Like, for example, we had a miscommunication once where someone did something that wasn't agreed on. And that's all I'll say. And it backfired on us with certain authorities. We weren't aware that they were going to do it. And we told them not to. And I still to this day don't know if they had an FU moment or if they sort of lost. I feel like it's the latter, that they lost sight of what was happening and they just kind of rolled with it. So I guess in some sense that could be considered the edge going over the edge.
More often than not, it usually with fire marshals. It's
okay
with certain parameters with fire marshals, and we've had to adapt, like, and then be like, no, actually that prop that we said was okay before is not okay halfway through the show.
Sure.
Now we have to pivot and change the act. And sometimes for an artist, like, that's, we're flexible, we're adaptable, but like sometimes you're like, damn, I really planned for this. I poured my heart into it. Well, you know, I got to make it work. And
right.
A lot of times the edge is when something outside of our control, a venue, authority, something in that matter tells us, hey, we have to change this now. And we're like, all right, like that's adapting.
I mean, listen, at the end of the day, the performers that we work with are seasoned nightlife performers. They've seen it all. But that's not to say that I'm going to subject anyone to a chaotic environment. Now, chaos is beautiful, but again, we have to have that structure first.
Yeah.
And then once the structure is in place and we have an explicit or an implicit, whatever, understanding, then we can go ahead and go nuts. But
in terms of burlesque too, like a lot, if we're doing a straight like burlesque show, there's certain parameters, like they call it the rules of burlesque. Just talking about consent, like we lay it all out too, you know, when we're in a more traditional setting, just so everything is clear and everybody's on the same page, you know, just the concept of consent is like the number one rule, you know, like, you know, unless there's consent, don't do it, you know, don't touch someone.
Even, you know? Just like, okay, so you would think that if you were at a party and there were people performing fire, and there's an obviously like a lit up ring with a distinction, you shouldn't go in that ring, right?
Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe someone's it's happened. Someone's drunk and, you know, maybe they're a little comfortable and they, you know, someone tries to dance with one of the fire performers. I have no, like, I'm not going to like judo throw someone, but I'm going to get like right up in front of them with the fire blanket and I'm going to push them out of the circle.
Yeah.
Which is what, right. You know, a fire safety is not just like, I'm here in case you burn yourself. It's I'm here to make sure that people don't, you know, and I would expect that for anyone that works with us that, that does fire safety. And the idea of that support, it's not just someone who holds a fire blanket and has access to an extinguisher. I should probably knock on wood, you know, there's burns, but it's very rare that we have anything super serious. You know what I mean? That's okay because we all have training and we know what we're doing. And that's, you know, but if something should happen, you know, you need someone that knows what to do. And we have a whole language. We have a whole fire program that is second nature to us and we know what to do. But that could be going over the edge, right? If maybe we didn't have a good safety. I mean, this is all purely hypothetical, so I don't even feel like, you know, that would certainly be an edge if people were up close and personal in a position where they could get hurt. Which just wouldn't happen. Like, we take what we do too seriously. I mean, we're very big sticklers for fire safety, and we're known for having a really good program.
That's great. Last thing, what would you hope someone walks away with after experiencing one of the shows?
To maybe be a little different, and to maybe, you know, it's okay to like be a little dark and be a little different, and you know, maybe not take the most traveled path, you know, to maybe take risk, you know.
I would love for, you know, people to feel like their own subconscious was made visible in some way. I would love for people to ask questions. It's almost like, you know, you could watch like a superhero movie and they're great. Like, they're super entertaining and they're really long and there's a lot happening and it's like visually stunning. But it's like, I can't remember most of them. Just like, you know, like modern horror movies. I can't remember. I can remember Rosemary's Baby. I can't remember like any Saw. Like, I don't know what's like, they all both bleed into one another for me. I would love for people to think about themselves and their place in the world. I would love for there to be that sense of unease and a sense of tension. I would love for people to talk about the show the next day. You know what I mean? How often do you see something and you're just like, that was cool. And then you're just off to whatever else. I mean, our attention spans are shot in general, but I would love for, you know, whether it's, you know, some people to be like, you know, I wonder what that meant, or I think it means that. Like, I would love for people to interpret, you know, like in their own way, what they felt it meant to have, I don't know, a blindfolded performer painted all white, wrapped in chains, being spun around, and then, you know, but whatever it is that we do, you know, like, that just popped into my head, like whatever acts that we do, you know, you get the idea.
Mike Gillespie, Anna Archaic, Diatema Arts. I did it right. Thank you so much.
Our accountant calls it diorama. He's like, I need dioramas, quarterly reports. Where are they?
Yeah. Thank you so much.
Yeah, man. Thanks for doing this podcast and having a great space for us to come and hang out and decompress.